Continuous glucose monitoring, CGM. Biofeedback you didn't know you needed. A small wire under the skin is rewriting how clinicians and patients understand blood sugar. Continuous glucose monitoring, CGM, gives a live look at a signal that used to stay invisible. It works as glycemic feedback, and like all good biofeedback, it does more than display numbers. It teaches the body to listen to itself. About this post, I am a biological psychologist and biofeedback researcher, not a physician, dietitian, or diabetes educator. I write here about CGM as a feedback instrument, what the signal is, where it errs, and how people learn from it, and about the behavioral side of glucose data, which is my field. The clinical claims are sourced to the primary literature and consensus guidelines cited throughout, but nothing here is medical advice. Decisions about medication, diet, and whether to wear a sensor at all belong with your own clinician. I also live with type 2 diabetes and wear a CGM. Where I describe my own numbers, I say so. A note on scope. This post addresses type 2 diabetes and people without diabetes. Type 1 diabetes, pregnancy, and pump integration raise distinct issues I do not cover here. This post explains what CGM is, why it helps people with and without diabetes, and how anyone can turn its feedback into smarter choices about food, movement, sleep, and stress. A sensor turns glucose into a story. Continuous glucose monitoring is a wearable system that estimates glucose around the clock through a small filament tucked just under the skin. The sensor does not measure blood directly. It samples interstitial fluid, the watery medium that surrounds body cells. Glucose moves from blood into this fluid with a brief delay, which clinicians call sensor lag. During steady periods, the lag is small. During rapid changes, such as the minutes after juice or a sprint, the screen value can trail the true value by 10 to 15 minutes. Teaching this fact up front spares patients a good deal of frustration. Watching glucose in real time is glycemic biofeedback. A patient sees the body respond to a meal, a walk, a rough night, or a tense phone call and adjusts. In type 2 diabetes, a chronic condition marked by insulin resistance and declining insulin production, the sensor converts an invisible signal into a readable pattern. In insulin resistance, muscle, liver, and fat cells respond weakly to insulin. The pancreas releases more to compensate, but that reserve erodes over the years. Glucose then climbs higher after meals and lingers longer than expected. The number on the screen is not a moral score, a diagnosis, or a perfect laboratory value. It is a trend line. The most useful clinical question is rarely, what is the value? It is closer to, what pattern is this showing, and what safe experiment could we run together? For practice, explain sensor lag at the very first visit. A patient who expects the screen to trail a rapid change will trust the device rather than abandon it. Why the signal matters for people with and without diabetes. Two forces drive the rapid uptake of CGM. People with diabetes want richer feedback than a single morning finger stick can provide. People without diabetes are increasingly curious about glucose as a wellness metric. Clearance of the first over-the-counter sensor widened access, and updated diabetes technology standards encourage earlier use. Healthy users often discover that soda, a late dinner, poor sleep, or a stressful meeting nudges their curve. Many have no framework for the observation. No consensus yet defines normal CGM patterns in people without diabetes, and a constant data stream can muddy the water as much as clarify it. A journalist who studies wearable health data has made the same argument for a general audience. Postprandial glucose. The glucose level after eating is where many patterns hide. Carbohydrates break down into glucose, enter the blood, and fuel the brain and muscles. Insulin escorts that glucose into cells and smooths the curve. The system works well until insulin resistance blunts it. Glycemic variability describes the up and down movement of glucose across hours and days. Two people can share one average. One rides gentle hills, and the other careens through peaks and valleys. CGM earns its keep here because it shows shape, not only altitude. Responses to the same meal vary widely from person to person. In a study of hundreds of adults, identical foods produced very different glucose responses, driven in part by the gut microbiome. CGM gives each person a personal map rather than a generic food chart. That is exactly why the device appeals to people with and without diabetes. Two patients can post an identical average while one glides and the other lurches. The daily shape of glucose, not the single number, is what a sensor reveals and a lab test hides. How repeated spikes may injure vessels and nerves. The biological concern is that repeated sharp rises may strain small vessels and nerves over time. Laboratory and clinical studies link acute glucose swings to oxidative stress, the cellular damage that accumulates when reactive molecules overwhelm antioxidant defenses. Those swings may also promote endothelial dysfunction, which is impaired health of the blood vessel lining and the buildup of advanced glycation end products, AGEs, sticky sugar protein molecules that stiffen tissues over years. This mechanism is not settled, and it is worth saying so plainly. A serious body of opinion holds that variability adds little predictive value once average glucose is accounted for, and the argument has been staged as a formal point-counterpoint in the literature. A randomized trial that successfully reduced glucose variability at matched A1C did not improve cardiovascular risk markers. The honest summary is that variability is strongly associated with complications, plausibly mechanistic, and not yet demonstrated to be independently causal. Where does 160 mg per deciliter fit? The International Diabetes Federation suggested a post-meal target below 160 mg per deciliter when it can be reached safely. Many CGM consensus reports use 70 to 180 mg per deciliter as the standard range for non-pregnant adults with diabetes. A spike over 160 is a meaningful early warning signal, not a proven injury switch. Peripheral neuropathy is damage to nerves of the feet, legs, hands, or arms. Lower CGM time in range has been associated with peripheral neuropathy in adults who have type 2 diabetes and chronic kidney disease, even when A1C was less informative. Cardiovascular autonomic neuropathy, CAN, is injury to the nerves that regulate heart rate and blood pressure. CGM time in range and time above range have both been linked to CAN in outpatients with type 2 diabetes. Retinopathy is damage to the small vessels of the retina, and nephropathy is kidney damage that often starts with albumin leaking into the urine. Studies in type 2 diabetes have tied lower time in range to retinopathy and to albuminuria. A systematic review concluded that time in range is associated with microvascular outcomes, while noting that more prospective research is needed. Macrovascular disease involves larger vessels, including coronary, cerebral, and peripheral arteries. Repeated spikes above 160 mg per deciliter may cumulatively raise risk, especially as part of a broader pattern of high time above range. The number invites pattern review and prevention rather than panic. One imperfect meal does not write a clinical sentence. What the trials actually show. The evidence for CGM is encouraging and still maturing. The mobile randomized trial in adults with type 2 diabetes on basal insulin found that CGM beat fingerstick monitoring on A1C. Systematic reviews report a modest A1C reduction, more time in range, and less time above range, though most trials were short. The evidence is widening beyond insulin-treated diabetes. A meta-analysis of trials in non-insulin-treated type 2 diabetes found better glycemic control with CGM than with usual monitoring. A later food choice trial in adults not taking insulin showed large within-group gains with CGM-supported self-care. A behavior change review concluded that CGM feedback can lower A1C and raise time in range, with awareness as the likely mechanism. CGM improves glycemic outcomes when patients receive enough education, structured feedback, and follow-up to act on the data. The device alone is not the treatment. Interpretation and behavior change are the treatment pathway. The problem with averages. Hemoglobin A1C, HbA1c, is a blood test that estimates average glucose exposure over roughly 3 months by measuring the fraction of hemoglobin bound to glucose. It is clinically useful and historically central to diabetes care, but an average can hide the daily story, much as a region's average summer temperature hides every heat wave. CGM brings a richer vocabulary. Time in range, TIR, is the percentage of readings within target, often 70 to 180 milligrams per deciliter. Time above range, TAR, is the percentage above target, often above 180 milligrams per deciliter. Time below range, TBR, is the percentage below target, often under 70 milligrams per deciliter, where safety becomes the dominant priority. Modern reports add three more summaries. The glucose management indicator, GMI, translates average sensor glucose into an A1C-like estimate. The ambulatory glucose profile, AGP, compresses many days of readings into one composite daily pattern. The coefficient of variation, CV, summarizes how widely glucose spreads around the average. A patient can post acceptable fasting readings and still experience repeated post-meal peaks between 160 and 180 milligrams per deciliter. Fasting glucose is a single morning snapshot. A1C is a three-month blur. Neither one reliably reveals whether breakfast, dinner, stress, medication timing, or a late-night snack is the source of the trouble. Reading your plate. The foods and snacks that spike the curve. The first practical use of CGM is simple. It shows which foods and snacks push glucose up and how far. A patient wears the sensor for 10 to 14 days and changes as little as possible about food, movement, and sleep. The goal is an honest picture of ordinary life, not perfect behavior. Patterns emerge fast. White rice, juice, sweetened coffee, or a late cookie may each produce a visible peak, while eggs or nuts barely move the line. Because responses are personal, the sensor outperforms any generic glycemic index chart. This appeals to people without diabetes who want to fine-tune wellness, and to people with diabetes who want fewer peaks. Meal order is a high-yield experiment. Crossover trials in adults with type 2 diabetes show that eating vegetables and protein first, with concentrated carbohydrates last, can cut post-meal peaks by roughly half compared with the reverse sequence. The change needs no new food and translates easily into ordinary meals. The sensor turns a vague rule into a personal test. A patient can eat the same dinner two nights in a row, switch the food order, and watch the peak fall by half. Proof on the screen beats advice on a handout. What the trials tested: eating protein and vegetables before starch, adding fiber to breakfast, and trimming one portion of refined carbohydrate. The sensor lets a patient compare the trace across two similar meals and see which change matters for them. Sustained changes to a meal plan, particularly for someone taking insulin or a sulfonylurea, belong with a clinician or registered dietitian. Movement you can watch work. For most people, the advice to exercise more goes in one ear and out the other. The patient who dislikes the gym has already heard the guidelines and nodded politely at the promised benefits. None of it sticks, because none of it pays off today. Even the real lift in mood after a brisk walk arrives too quietly to compete with the comfort of the couch. Continuous glucose monitoring changes the math by making the payoff impossible to miss. When a patient watches a 15-minute walk shave the top off a post-meal spike, the abstract becomes concrete, and the screen delivers the feedback in minutes rather than months. Meta-analyses of post-meal movement support what the trace shows in real time. Walking soon after eating blunts the rise in glucose more effectively than the same walk taken earlier or later. Even 10 minutes can visibly flatten the curve. That visible win rewards the behavior on the spot and quietly builds the patient's confidence that their own choices move the needle. Actionable step: encourage a 10 to 15 minute walk within an hour of the largest meal and ask the patient to watch the peak fall on the sensor. Clear new activity with the treating clinician first when there is autonomic neuropathy, active retinopathy, foot ulceration, or treatment with insulin or a sulfonylurea where exercise timing interacts with hypoglycemia risk. When stress, illness, and poor sleep move the line, CGM also reveals influences unrelated to food. Acute psychological stress can raise glucose within minutes. Stress triggers counter-regulatory hormones, including cortisol and adrenaline, that prompt the liver to release stored glucose. In adults with type 2 diabetes, an experimental stressor raised glucose measurably. On the screen, a tense meeting can look a lot like a small meal. Brief illness can do the same thing. Infection and other acute stress states raise counter-regulatory hormones and provoke stress hyperglycemia, a temporary rise in glucose during acute illness. A cold or a flare can lift the CGM trace for several days. Recognizing this pattern keeps a patient from blaming a food that was not the cause. Sleep matters more than many patients expect. Obstructive sleep apnea, OSA, a disorder characterized by repeated nighttime pauses in breathing, is closely associated with insulin resistance and poorer glucose control. Short sleep also impairs metabolism. Restricting healthy men to about 5 hours of sleep per night for 1 week reduced insulin sensitivity by roughly 11 to 20%. A higher, flatter overnight trace after a poor night can open a useful conversation about sleep. Mornings carry their own signal. The dawn phenomenon is a circadian rise in glucose in the early morning hours, driven by the normal overnight release of counter-regulatory hormones. In type 2 diabetes, its median magnitude by CGM is about 16 milligrams per deciliter, and it adds roughly 0.4% to HbA1c. A patient who sees a pre-breakfast climb can learn that it reflects biology, not a midnight snack. CGM turns invisible influences into visible feedback. Stress, infection, short sleep, and the dawn rise each leave a footprint on the trace. Naming the cause is often more useful than adjusting the last meal. For practice, when overnight or morning glucose runs high without a dietary cause, screen for sleep apnea, ask about sleep duration and recent illness, and treat short-lived spikes as temporary rather than as failures. Calibrating the signal you trust. A CGM reading is an estimate, and estimates deserve a cross-check. Sensor accuracy, often summarized as mean absolute relative difference, MARD, varies across the glucose range and during rapid change. A confirmatory finger stick with a glucometer during a suspected low and a clear high teaches a patient how well the sensor tracks at both ends. This matters most when symptoms do not match the screen, a situation that calls for prompt confirmation before treating. Calibration also works over longer windows. A patient can compare the CGM's multi-week average and its GMI against a laboratory HbA1c. The two rarely match exactly, because A1c is weighted toward recent weeks. Glucose from the preceding 30 days contributes about half of the A1c value, with progressively less weight given to earlier weeks. This weighting explains a common mismatch: a roughly 12-week CGM average and an A1C that reflects the similar but recency-weighted window can diverge when glucose has been changing. When the two agree, their confidence rises. When they diverge, the gap itself is information about a recent shift, sensor bias, or a red cell condition that alters A1C. Trust the sensor, but verify it. A few paired finger sticks at the high and low ends calibrate a patient's eye for the whole range. And a GMI checked against a recency-weighted A1C calibrates the long view. The author's experience. My own type 2 diabetes values show how much these methods can diverge. Over 12 weeks, my average CGM reading corresponded to 6.2%, while my lab A1C came in at 5.1%. At the moment of a lab blood draw, my CGM read 120 mg per deciliter against a lab value of 101 mg per deciliter. One morning while fasting, my CGM showed 119 mg per deciliter versus 111 mg per deciliter by fingerstick. And 30 minutes after lunch, the CGM registered 186 mg per deciliter, while a fingerstick read just 136 mg per deciliter. In the next section, we explore why these three measurement methods, CGM, fingerstick, and lab blood draw, can disagree while remaining valid. The practical takeaway: check your CGM against fingerstick readings when the trend arrow is flat and glucose is steady, while fasting, before a meal, and whenever your glucose runs low, below 70 mg per deciliter. A post-meal comparison is the least informative test you can run, because disagreement at the peak reflects expected physiology rather than device error. My own 186 versus 136 reading above demonstrates lag, not a faulty sensor. One clarification about the verb: most current sensors are factory calibrated, and some cannot be user calibrated at all. What these paired readings calibrate is your interpretation, not the device. Consult the manufacturer's instructions before entering any calibration value, and never enter one while glucose is changing rapidly. Actionable steps: collect a small set of paired finger stick and sensor values across the glucose range, each taken when the trend arrow is flat, and compare GMI with a laboratory A1C at each visit, treating any gap as a clue rather than an error. Why CGM and lab values disagree? A CGM number and a laboratory glucose can differ by 20, 30, or even 50 mg per deciliter. The gap rarely means that one device is broken. The two methods measure different fluid at different moments, and each carries its own error. Understanding the sources of disagreement keeps patients and clinicians from chasing a false problem. The sensor and the lab sample two different compartments. A blood draw measures glucose in blood, while the CGM estimates glucose in interstitial fluid. Glucose reaches the interstitial space by diffusing out of the capillaries, so the compartments are not identical when glucose is moving. The physiologic delay measures about 5 to 6 minutes, and the sensor algorithm adds more. So the screen can trail true blood glucose by 10 minutes or longer during a rapid rise or fall. The two values are almost never captured at the same instant. Glucose is a moving target. A venous sample captures a single moment, while the CGM reports a slightly older, smoothed estimate. A change of even 15 mg per deciliter in the intervening minutes can be mistaken for a device error. Blood itself does not yield one single value. Plasma glucose, which the laboratory reports, runs about 11% higher than whole blood glucose at a normal hematocrit, the fraction of blood made up of red cells. Capillary blood glucose from a fingertip and venous blood glucose also differ. They are nearly equal when fasting, but after a meal, a fingertip reading can exceed a venous reading by roughly 20 to 25 mg per deciliter. Sample handling can pull the laboratory value down. After a draw, blood cells continue consuming glucose through glycolysis, the process of breaking down glucose for energy. Without prompt processing or an adequate preservative, glucose decreases by about 5 to 7% per hour, and standard fluoride tubes do not fully prevent this loss in the first hour. A sample that waits before spinning can read falsely low, which makes the CGM look falsely high. The CGM carries its own error band its accuracy, summarized as MARD, averages roughly 8 to 10% and is worse on the first day and at the lower end of the range. A compression low, caused by lying on the sensor, can produce a sudden overnight false low that no blood draw would detect. High-dose acetaminophen can also falsely raise readings on some sensor chemistries. CGM and lab values agree best when glucose is flat and stable, such as fasting in the morning, and diverge most when it is changing fast. The honest comparison uses a flat trend arrow, not a post-meal peak, and treats a mismatch as expected physiology rather than a defect. Actionable steps. Compare a finger stick or lab draw with the sensor only when the trend arrow is flat and glucose is steady. Confirm any low before treating it, and judge overall agreement by the multi-week average and GMI rather than a single paired reading. Approved wear sites differ by device and by generation, and the difference is not trivial. The Dexcom G6 was indicated for abdominal wear. The G7, sold without a prescription as Stelo, is indicated for the back of the upper arm only in U.S. adults. Site-specific accuracy data do not transfer automatically between locations. Follow the instructions for the specific sensor in use and raise any question about placement with the prescribing clinician rather than improvising. After consultation, the author switched to an abdominal site above the waistline when CGM values were unacceptably high across the G7 sensor's range. In this case example, abdominal values achieved acceptable accuracy. If you experience the same issue, please talk to your physician. What CGM adds to behavioral healthcare? Diabetes distress is the emotional weight of living with diabetes. It includes worry, frustration, shame, burnout, and the quiet exhaustion of decisions that never end. Distress is common across cultures and care settings, and it independently undermines glycemic control and well-being. It is also treatable. A 2024 meta-analysis of randomized trials found that tailored psychological interventions, including cognitive behavioral therapy and mindfulness, significantly reduced diabetes distress in adults with type 2 diabetes. CGM can ease or worsen this picture, depending on how the data are framed. It can reduce distress by replacing guessing with understandable feedback. It can amplify distress when it becomes a constant reminder that the body is being watched and judged. One version of that risk deserves its own name. For some people, continuous glucose data becomes a scoring system for eating. In anyone with a history of restrictive eating, orthorexia, or body image disorder, a sensor can convert ordinary meals into a source of moral judgment delivered every 5 minutes, and the tighter the self-monitoring, the more the device rewards it. Screen for this history before recommending CGM as a wellness tool. Watch for it developing in patients who already wear one, and be willing to recommend that the sensor come off. For clinical psychologists and counselors, CGM functions as a behavioral map. A rise in glucose after a lonely evening snack is not just a nutritional event. It can be the visible footprint of an emotion regulation loop that includes fatigue, deprivation, habit, reward, and self-criticism. Naming the loop is often more therapeutic than naming the carbohydrate. Motivational interviewing is a collaborative counseling style that helps patients connect change to their own values rather than to instruction. It pairs naturally with CGM because the data invite curiosity rather than compliance. Useful prompts include what the patient noticed, what surprised them, and which small change feels realistic this week. Hypoglycemia, meaning low glucose and commonly defined as below 70 milligrams per deciliter, changes the safety calculus entirely. For patients on insulin or insulin-stimulating medications, trimming spikes must never create new lows. Clinicians should encourage prompt medical coordination when CGM reveals frequent or overnight lows, or symptoms that do not match the reading. What CGM can miss, mislead, or magnify? CGM has real limits that matter clinically. Because the sensor estimates glucose from interstitial fluid, rapid changes can appear late on the screen. Pressure on the sensor during sleep can occasionally produce falsely low readings. Skin irritation from adhesives is not unusual. Sensors also have to be removed before MRI, CT, and X-ray imaging, which interrupts data at exactly the moments patients are most likely to be unwell. CGM should not become a standalone diagnostic tool. People without diabetes lack a clear framework for interpreting every fluctuation, and constant data can produce confusion and needless anxiety when cost and interpretation are not addressed. The same caution applies in type 2 diabetes, though the rationale for monitoring is stronger there. A single 180 milligrams per deciliter reading should be considered alongside the preceding meal, the medication regimen, the sleep window, and the broader report. Not all wearables are equal. The FDA has warned consumers not to rely on smartwatches or smart rings that claim to measure glucose without piercing the skin, because no such device had been authorized. Clinicians should ask exactly which device a patient uses. CGM can also widen health inequity, since sensors carry out-of-pocket costs and insurance rules vary by plan. A single 180 milligrams per deciliter reading should not be catastrophized. It should be placed next to the preceding meal, the medication regimen, the sleep window, the activity log, and the broader CGM report. Turning sensor data into better conversations. A useful clinical rhythm starts simple. The patient wears CGM for 10 to 14 days while changing as little as possible in diet, activity, or sleep. The next visit converts the AGP into a single question. Why does breakfast produce a steep rise, or why does glucose drift upward overnight? One focused question is more actionable than 10 ambient alarms. Then comes the first experiment, and it should be small and safe. A patient might add protein or fiber to breakfast, rearrange meal order, or take a short post-meal walk. A second experiment can address context by testing sleep, stress, alcohol, or illness, one variable at a time. The CGM serves as a hypothesis checker rather than a verdict generator. Medication conversations belong squarely in this rhythm. If time above range stays high despite feasible lifestyle changes, the report becomes evidence for a therapy discussion. If time below range is observed in a patient on insulin or a sulfonylurea, a safety review should occur promptly. The CGM is not a substitute for prescribing judgment, but it is excellent shared data. Stated as plainly as it deserves, no one should change a medication dose on the basis of sensor readings without their prescriber. The final piece is naming the win. For many adults with diabetes, the consensus goal is at least 70% time in range with minimal time below range, individualized for age, comorbidity, and hypoglycemia risk. For some patients, the first win is fewer breakfast peaks or a lower CV. Naming a small, achievable target is what builds the self-efficacy that sustains change. Integrative summary. CGM is best understood as a pattern recognition tool. It reveals what fasting glucose and HbA1c routinely hide. The daily rhythm of meals, movement, stress, sleep, illness, and recovery. In type 2 diabetes, that rhythm matters because repeated high glucose exposure may, over time, contribute to nerve, vascular, renal, and retinal injury. In people without diabetes, the same feedback can guide food and movement, though it needs careful interpretation to avoid false alarms. The thesis holds with two guardrails. First, spikes over 160 milligrams per deciliter are meaningful, but not a proven sharp threshold for damage. Second, CGM helps only when the data meet the criteria of education, calibration, safety planning, equitable access, and psychological context. For healthcare providers, the practical promise of CGM is not more numbers. It is a better conversation. CGM helps patients trade vague failure narratives for testable hypotheses, smaller experiments, and more compassionate self-management. The technology cannot deliver that outcome on its own, but clinicians and patients can build it together with the data the sensor provides. 5 key takeaways. 1. CGM is most powerful as patterned feedback, not as a verdict on a patient or a meal. 2. A1C and fasting glucose can look acceptable while post-meal peaks still occur between 160 and 180 milligrams per deciliter. 3. Food order, a short post-meal walk, better sleep, and stress management each leave a visible mark on the trace, so patients can safely test one change at a time. 4. Stress, brief illness, obstructive sleep apnea, short sleep, and the dawn phenomenon can all raise glucose with no dietary cause. 5. Confirm the sensor with occasional finger sticks at highs and lows, and compare its multi-week average and GMI against a recency-weighted laboratory A1C.